They're not talking about the best of them. They're just talking about the rest of them. Not the worst parts, but the best parts. This is the best of the rest.
Hello and welcome to Best of the Rest, the show where we take a second look at comic book movies that were poorly received upon release and dive into everything the movie actually did well. It's sometimes a challenge to do so, but it's always a good time. And this week, we are talking Spider-Man 3. I am joined, as always, by comic book connoisseur Andrew Williams. Andrew, you ready for this one?
I am, yes, very ready for this.
What's your history with this movie? You had to have seen this in theaters, right?
Yeah, of course. I think everybody, when this... I remember people being pretty amped for this. People were, pretty stoked to see, after Spider-Man 2, see them go take the Venom route. And I remember my friends and I, we were living in Huntsville, because that's where I went to college, and we tried to go to a Friday night screening opening weekend, and it was, sold out. Every screening that night was sold. This is long before the days of online tickets with reserves.
Buy your seat, yeah.
this was 2007. This is Wild West when it came to movies. You were still in the Wild West. You were still buy your tickets, get there 7 hours early, wait in line, that sort of thing. So no, I remember a good amount of hype for this.
The movie was definitely hyped. We've talked a lot on the show about how in the early 2000s, it's all X-Men and Spider-Man. There's a ton of adaptations, but those are the tentpole movies. That's what's carrying the superhero renaissance. So Spider-Man 3, just like X-Men 3, was a big deal. Personally, yeah. I did not see it in theaters. I'm probably the only person in the world that didn't. Yeah. I mean, Andrew, you know this. I'm not the biggest fan of the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies. Even at the time, from day one, I saw Spider-Man 1 in theaters, and personally, it's a cherished memory of mine. I went with my stepdad. It was a midnight showing. It was a good time. Then I walked out, and I was that was okay. There was some problems I had with it.
Wow.
Didn't really grab me. Yeah, I was much more of an X-Men guy, I guess. I don't know, but it just didn't grab me. And Spider-Man 2, I liked, but I still had problems with it, and I just was not on board. Didn't bother seeing this one. But Andrew, let's set the stage a little bit. Let's look at these numbers. Our show is about superhero movies that were poorly received. But this movie made $895 million at the box office. It's the highest grossing of the trilogy. And the reviews aren't terrible. 63% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's certified fresh. So, Andrew, why are we talking about this movie?
If I could point out, the audience score is only 51. So I think you have a built-in argument right there. But there was a good amount of backlash against this movie from fans. There was a pretty heavy dislike of some of the story decisions, some of the casting choices. Just in general, I think there was an overall disappointment at just mostly, I think I'm just going to say it outright, how they chose to go about doing the symbiote and Venom specifically. I think those are the biggest sources of criticism.
There's a lot going on in this movie. Yeah.
It's a very long movie too. I think it's well over 2 hours. I think so.
Yeah, people were angry. You know, this was a beloved franchise, and they felt betrayed by what happened in this third movie. So even though everybody went to see it, some people saw it multiple times. It definitely got a bad word of mouth very early on, and you know, someone who was. I'm graduating high school around this time. I remember this movie coming out. I remember that backlash, and that's always stuck with me that, hey, the third Spider-Man is not great. But what's interesting about this movie's reputation is it has changed a bit over time. These days you go on Twitter, you go online, and there's definitely defenders of this movie.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's due to a couple things. One, I think is people a little bit younger than us, they're going to grow up not remembering this movie being released and that backlash. They just look at the Spider-Man trilogy all as one piece because maybe they were 5 or 6 years old when this came out. It's kind of like someone our age thinking about the Batman movies of the 90s. We don't think about there's the Burton movies and then there's a big drop off and the Schumachers.
Right.
Growing up, it was just Batman. It was all Batman. And we didn't really see much of a difference. So there's definitely some people a little bit younger that have that view of this trilogy. And the other thing that has worked in this movie's favor, oddly, is memes. This trilogy is memed to death. And there's almost like an ironic appreciation that turns into general admiration when that happens. I've seen the same thing happen with the Star Wars prequels. Again, people a little bit older remember those movies coming out, and most people hating them and being trashed. And then there's definitely this younger generation that grew up with those movies and has made the memes of those movies and end up genuinely enjoying them. And there's nothing wrong with any of that, by the way. No, I mean, everybody can have their own view of the movie.
The world's on fire. Enjoy what you can.
Absolutely. So, as I mentioned, I'm not the biggest fan of this series, but I would consider myself a Sam Raimi fan. I love the Evil Dead movies and on and off some of the stuff he's done throughout his career, which is certainly an interesting one. His filmography is not, you think you have the guy pinned, you think he's, Evil Dead, like he's low budget, corny, hokey, campy. Even the Spider-Man series is a bit campy, but then he goes off and what are some of the movies this guy has made?
For the Love of the Game.
For the Love of the Game.
Like, obviously, there's like Darkman, and there's like the Hudsucker Proxy that he writes on, and then there's The Quick and the Dead, A Simple Plan, stuff like that. That's all like those are not like lightweight movies. I mean, those are some pretty well liked movies. Like the Hudsucker Proxy is a Coen Brothers movie that Sam Raimi co-wrote and stuff like that. So,
and then there's something like Oz the Great and Powerful, which I don't even know how to categorize that.
Which
I don't
is
know
the if- last movie. He's in production now with Doctor Strange 2, but he does all of the Spider-Mans. Then he does Drag Me to Hell and Oz, and that's it. He kind of stops making movies at that point.
He breaks into the industry with Evil Dead, which is my favorite director story. Just get some friends together, get some money together, bang out a script, and let's go get this thing done. I have huge admiration for anybody that does that. Robert Rodriguez is another one. Tarantino, I think it's like the cool way to get into Hollywood, right? Not film school, just going out there, in his case, in the woods and making a movie that everyone loves. And then it's almost like he wanted to try to be like a studio man and just do kind of the down the middle projects. And it's interesting choices. I'm pretty fascinated by this guy.
Yeah, I was just say, even I think picking him at all to do Spider-Man was an interesting choice, because nowadays you get those people that do like a big hit indie picture, and then they get like zoomed up by the studio. Like, you know, Colin Trevorrow is a good example, where like he did Safety Not Guaranteed and then was like immediately grabbed to do Jurassic World, which is like an ocean in regards to like the difference in budgets and the difference in scope and the difference in everything.
And it's an interesting point of what you're saying about people getting kind of hot shot into the superhero game. You look at the current Spider-Man movies, that director got a start on YouTube, I believe. That was like his claim to fame before taking on Spider-Man. John Watts.
John Watts, yeah.
Yeah, so what I love about the decision is that he's clearly a Spider-Man fan, and that shows as much as... I'll try not to complain about these movies the whole episode, I promise. As much as I have problems with some of these movies, you can definitely tell that there's a love there and a passion there, and it comes through. I think it's super important with adaptations like this. This third installment is actually written by Sam Raimi, along with his brother, Ivan, and the studio coughs up a lot of money to bring Alvin Sargent back for this one. This man's credits go all the way back to the 60s. I took a quick note that he was born in 1927. And the reason I did that is one of my thoughts as I was watching this movie is, man, how old is the person that wrote this? There's literally a scene where Mary Jane and Harry Osborn are in the kitchen cooking together, and they do the twist. Like, that's what's playing on the radio, and that's their bonding moment. They do the twist. Of course, you've got Tobey Maguire. Whenever he has the symbiote on, he's a little bit more aggressive. He says things like, "I'm gonna put dirt in your eye," which to me is such like a 1950s.
It's a very dated thing to say, which is weird because Alvin Sargent apparently has some work on all of this trilogy. Like, he's an uncredited writer on Spider-Man. He's a credited writer on 2 and 3. I think he's the only writer on 2. And then he's actually a co-writer on The Amazing Spider-Man that comes after this. It's odd because, unlike the others, this one definitely has like moments where like it's just very odd, very dated things. Or moments to me that feel very much like, how do you do, fellow kids? Because like there's a scene in the final fight. I think it's when Harry shows up to save Spider-Man. And one of the kids is like, "Wow, wicked cool." And I'm like, "What? Why? Like, what do you like? Why are you saying this right now? It's so strange." Also, one other thing I do want to point out: Ivan Raimi is also not the brother of Sam Raimi that people think he is, because Ted Raimi is the one that everybody knows about.
Ted Raimi did the 90s TV shows, right? Like Hercules and stuff. Is that Ted?
Yeah. And he, well, Ted's also in these movies. He plays Jonah's assistant. That's Ted Raimi. Okay. He shows up in a lot of things. But like, Ivan Raimi is an American doctor of osteopathic medicine. So like, he's a genuine like emergency physician that just occasionally writes scripts for movies. And I've always thought that was really funny.
That's a cool career for sure.
Yeah, it's like, I'm going to take a break from the hospital for a bit. Got to go write a script for my brother's movie.
Let's take a look at this cast. A lot of them returning from the previous two movies, of course. But as is tradition, we're going to start at the top, at the high point. And I'm going to know, Andrew, who you think elevates this movie. Who absolutely kills their role and single-handedly improves the score of this movie. If you think it's a 6 out of 10, they make it a 7 out of 10. We call it the Mark Strong Award. Andrew, who gets the Mark Strong Award for you?
I want to start by saying that it's very easy to say that J.K. Simmons deserves this for the whole trilogy. I don't necessarily think he deserves it in this movie. I'm going to give it to somebody else, but I want to specifically call out that he's one of the people. I mean, he was so popular, they ended up bringing him back for the MCU. He's one of the few actors that they've done that with. And this may be an odd choice to people, and I don't necessarily think he's given a whole lot to work with. But my MVP of this movie is Thomas Hayden Church as Flint Marko.
I agree. He gets my Mark Strong Award as well.
I've always kind of liked Thomas Hayden Church. I actually remember him from like very strange places. Like I remember he's the general antagonist in the George of the Jungle movie.
That's
with
exactly. I watched that movie a lot back in the day. It's exactly what I think.
But
of
also
too.
Like,
and when I was looking at his filmography, he stuck around and he shows up in the sequel, the direct to video
oh,
sequel.
Wow. I didn't,
Brendan
I didn't
Fraser even, didn't do Brendan, it, but he came back for the second
Brendan
one.
Brendan Fraser doesn't do it, but he does. And like, I obviously he's very well known in your parents' circles for being on Wings, which was a show that I'm sure all parents watched, but no kids ever did.
Also Sideways, which is also very much a parents' movie.
But I've always liked Thomas Hayden Church. And when they announced he was playing in this movie, I thought it was great. Even at the time, I thought it was a great casting. I thought it was a great choice. I thought it was a really good way to bring in somebody that's got like some gravitas as a new character. And I think he does a great job. He's got some stuff that I genuinely think is really kind of great. Like that scene where him and Spider-Man are fighting like in the armored car and Spider-Man is just like, you're going to have to get through me. And he's just like, okay. And just punches him immediately. And like,
the best action scenes I think is when Sandman and Spider-Man are fighting 101. Mm-hmm. When there's other elements involved, it worked quite as well. But when it's just them two, it happens a couple times in the movie. I think it's very good. And yeah, Thomas Hayden Church, I like the guy too. Such an interesting voice. I don't know how to categorize it.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if it's the t-shirt they put him in, but he just looks like the comic book Sandman come to life.
And he really does.
I don't know if genuinely. It's really his features or the costuming, but whatever, they put it all together and they made it work. I don't know if it's quite to the level where I would say I can't imagine anyone else ever playing this role.
Right.
Inevitably, but it's going to happen at some point, but he certainly does a great job.
He's really well done in this. And like I said, I really do think he does like look like the character. And like, I do think part of it's the look. It's a very simple look, but it's very, I think it identifies it, especially after like seeing it in like the animated series from the 90s or something like that. You kind of have that shirt for some reason. It's just a green striped shirt. I have no idea why it's like iconic, but it kind of is.
Since you mentioned him already, let's talk about J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson. Now, this is a character I can't imagine anyone else ever playing this role. He, like you said, entire trilogy, he owns J. Jonah Jameson. And for him, it's not just the look. They give him the hair and everything, but his mannerisms, his cadence, and his voice.
Like everything. Yeah.
I feel like I was reading Spider-Man comics before I saw the movies and I heard J.K. Simmons' voice in my head. Like it's that synonymous with the characters that I just can't separate it. He doesn't get my Mark Strong Award just because he's not so integral to the main plot. Mm-hmm. And if he played in a little bit more, maybe I would go that direction. But he's a high point throughout the entire series, throughout all three movies.
Oh, yeah. And I think he actually is one of my favorite scenes in the first one where, like, after being like this kind of unrelenting jerk the whole movie, the minute Green Goblin threatens him and asks who takes the pictures of Spider-Man, Jonah immediately covers for Peter and says, I don't know. He sends him in the mail. So, and a lot of people think that's just Jameson covering for himself. But like those moments to me, I'm like, I see that more as like, he realizes the kid's in danger and he's a kid. Like Jameson's not a monster. And so like, yeah. I like moments like that. He gets a lot of things like that where he gets these little moments where kind of you see there's something beneath the surface, but
there's like, a bit of a facade or character that the character is playing, if you will.
Right. He's J. Jonah Jameson is also playing J. Jonah Jameson in a way. And it's interesting because the films that follow this don't even bother trying to do J. Jonah Jameson. They never get there. Whether they would have or not with a third installment is a different question, but like they never bother to introduce him. And then obviously within Far From Home, the MCU, they opted to simply bring Simmons back. Like you said, that whole thing is just, I can't imagine anybody else playing him. And inevitably somebody else will. They always will. But again, he's, like I said, not the MVP of the movie, but I think he definitely deserves a shout out for his work across this whole trilogy.
Now, of course, we're going to talk about Tobey Maguire as Peter Parker / Spider-Man. And look, I don't know if this is a hot take or if everybody agrees with me, but the biggest problem, I've talked about how I don't love these movies too much. The biggest problem throughout this entire series is that your main cast of Tobey Maguire, Kirsten Dunst, and James Franco are the worst part acting wise.
There's just not a lot of chemistry between
after
them.
After a movie. Yeah. Okay. Spider-Man 1. Who do you think of who does a great job? You've got J.K. Simmons, of course. And you've got Willem Dafoe as the villain. No one is listing Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst or James Franco as the highlight of that movie. And the same one for number two, you think of Alfred Molina, right? That comes to mind first. But I will say this, in this movie, I feel like Tobey Maguire, he figures it out. He turns it on. And this is his best performance as Peter Parker and Spider-Man. I think I really like what he's doing here.
I actually agree, generally speaking. I rewatched them all a bit out of order. And just in this one, almost all of them, I think Franco, too, kind of relaxes a little bit more into the role. I wouldn't necessarily say he's like knocking it out of the park, but he definitely feels more at ease. Like in the first movies, he feels very kind of stiff. But in this one, kind of, I guess, leaning into like being the Goblin a little bit and kind of going with it, he seems to relax and ease up a little bit. And even when he's kind of like amnesiac and he's thinking they're all buddies, like he feels more like Peter's friend in that part of this movie than he ever does in the other ones.
Yeah, and all so three of them really step it up. And I don't know why that is. Maybe it just took them a long time to get that chemistry between each other. Maybe they all got a huge bump in pay and decided to turn it on a little bit. I don't know. I'm not going to try to guess, but whatever it is, it's working. Yeah. The first half of this movie, man, I am so on board. The second installment begins to really dive into Peter Parker's personal life and his life as Spider-Man colliding with each other. And they pick that right up in this one. And I think they do a lot of great things. Spider-Man is finally popular. The citizens see him as a hero. It starts to kind of go to his head, even without the symbiote. He starts thinking a little bit highly of himself and not paying attention to Mary Jane Watson, who has her own issues going on. And that dynamic, it works so well. And I love all the decisions that Tobey Maguire is making as Peter Parker.
I agree. I that was the thing I noticed specifically watching them kind of back to back.
Wait a minute. I got to go back. I don't love all the decisions that he makes as Peter Parker, but most of them.
And I like I said, whether that's his fault or it's just the decisions of the movie is a different question. But no, I think here, like I said, I feel like everybody kind of gels, at least as far as like feeling relaxed in their roles. Like Tobey Maguire feels like he's more confident playing Peter Parker. Franco is obviously, I think, leaning a little bit into like going full villain, and you can see he's enjoying kind of hamming it up and really kind of having some fun with it. And it shows. And it, like you said, it's kind of odd that for a movie that gets sidelined as much as it does, arguably it's the best this cast has ever been. Just really because oddly, like Sandman is not a driving force in this movie. Really. He's part of what's happening, but he's not, I would say, as prevalent as say Dafoe or Molina were. And so you kind of really, a huge chunk of this movie is just focusing on that core cast in a way
they do a good job
kind of weren't. And so I think given like whether it's giving them that focus, whether it's having that focus instead of just kind of being ciphers for the story, they all take it and they run with it. Generally speaking, I think it's pretty good. You get Mary Jane struggling with her personal stuff that Peter is kind of aloof and isn't really realizing, and that leaves Harry to form some tension as well. And so it's pretty great.
Up until Spider-Man 3, I'd always said they did their best work in other movies, because it's not like these are bad actors by any means. Tobey Maguire in movies like Pleasantville, Cider House Rules. I like Seabiscuit. I like his roles. I like these actors. Yeah. They just weren't gelling for a while. Kirsten Dunst as Mary Jane Watson. Great casting. I mean, this girl walked out of their womb acting. She's been doing it forever. Mm-hmm. Interview with the Vampire was certainly my introduction to her. I grew up watching that movie, and she is phenomenal. I mean, she in the movie, she is a child playing an adult, and you totally buy it. She's not like good. You know, sometimes you look at child actors like, yeah, they're good for a kid. They're good for a child actor. She just flat out kills it, and she handles her own with freaking Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt. It's a fantastic performance.
Oh, yeah. I obviously Jumanji is the one that I remember her from primarily, as well as what was that one? Small Soldiers.
Yeah. I love that movie.
Yeah.
Great soundtrack.
Joe Dante does Small Soldiers. Great movie. So she's, like I said, she's kind of like Drew Barrymore, that she's been acting pretty much her whole life and really kind of without a break. Like, there's not really a moment where like Kirsten
there's not a separation
isn't
between the
acting,
child acting. And yeah.
Yeah. And like,
she eases into more adult roles, like Bring It On. Virgin Suicide is probably one of her earlier dramatic adult roles.
Yeah.
And then right into Spider-Man.
She's obviously got one of hers I actually really like is in 2006. They did a Marie Antoinette movie she was in. I actually really like that. That's actually just before this. So she was always an interesting choice. What I always thought was funny is that she's a blonde that they cast as a redhead. And then all the women that have played Gwen Stacy so far are also known for being redheads, and they make them blonde. I'm just like, always thought that was weird.
They handle that. I believe it's like a wig in the first one, and then they dye her hair in the second one. I watch these movies with my daughter, which I think really, really helps to see like how a kid reacts to these movies that's never seen them before. And when she first saw her in Spider-Man 2, they're like, hey, they recast Mary Jane. I was like, no, it's still her. It's just different hair. Don't worry about it. But we're saying we're having a positive conversation about Spider-Man 3. There's no rules about what we can say about Spider-Man 1 and 2. And I think she is a black hole of charisma throughout Spider-Man 1 and 2, along with Tobey Maguire. And I'll try not to harp on that point this whole time, but it just, what I'm setting up here,
buddy.
in Spider-Man 3, she does a great job. Just like Tobey Maguire, she turns it on and she is killing it. We're going to get to my favorite scene here in a moment, but it involves both of them together. And I think it's phenomenal.
I think part of it too is I think she's given way more to do here than she is in the other movies.
Sure.
She actually gets like an arc. It's not just it's kind of like she was doing these things in a sequence, but it was more like in relation to Peter. And in this series, she's kind of given her own arc that separates her from Peter, essentially, literally in some cases. But like having her have the show, and then have that taken away from her, and then have to get like the job as like the waitress, the singing waitress. Like, you're giving her highs, you're giving her lows, you're giving her progression that she's really, I don't think, gets in the other ones. So I think having that and having something that I would just assume as an actor, having something that kind of gives you a better chance to dig in, just obviously is going to make you want to bring out more versus just kind of being the aside to Spider-Man.
That's true. That's a good point. These movies have a tendency to, she's often in danger in the finale, hanging from a high place, and it would be easy to really reduce her character to that, to damsel in distress. But by, like you said, giving her more to do, giving her own arc, it lends a lot to the character. And she shows up, she rises to the occasion, and does a great job here.
Yeah.
James Franco is Harry Osborn / Green Goblin, Green Goblin 2, New Green Goblin, whatever you want to call him.
New Goblin, as he's credited on Wiki, but yeah.
The Spider-Man movies were my introduction to James Franco, and I'm going to stop talking about how much I don't like the acting in the movie, but I remember I saw these movies, and then I know he was in Flyboys, which I never saw, but it didn't look great to me. And I kind of wrote this guy off as not a great actor. Maybe he was hired for, you know, because he's
looks or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And then down the road, he starts, of course, partnering up with Seth Rogen and kind of showing more of his comedic chops. And then he does something like 128 hours. And I'm like, where did this come from? This guy just turns it on later in his career. It reminds me a lot of how I felt about Matthew McConaughey, who I got introduced to with a lot of like romantic comedies that I don't, that he's, you know, he's just a whatever role, he's a pretty face. And then all of a sudden he does The Lincoln Lawyer in Mud and Dallas Buyers Club. And I'm like, why did you just decide to start being awesome? Yeah. Where
was all this the whole time? And it's, no, I agree. And Franco is like, I assume this must have been my introduction to Franco, because I didn't see like Freaks and Geeks until later. So like something like that obviously wouldn't have made a lot of an impact. As I mentioned earlier, I think he finally kind of relaxes into this role here, just because I think he gets to lean into the villain stuff. And obviously, I think there's some fun to be had with that.
There's the amnesia bit of the movie. And then once he gets his memories back and he gets to be this smarmy, scheming douchebag.
Yeah, he kind of like he really gets to go like full Snidely Whiplash, kind of like in a, to borrow a very dated reference. He kind of gets to really just like he gets to like he makes MJ break up with Peter. He like
that scene in particular where that happens on the bridge where MJ breaks up with him and then the camera pulls back and he's like behind a tree.
Like hanging out in the woods. I was like,
I can just hear in my head like and he rubs his hands together.
Like
it's perfect.
Like twirling his mustache like fucking just like, or was it Dick Dastardly from Wacky Races or something, like just hanging out there. And it's that scene is just so over the top to me. And like the scene in the diner where like he's talking to Peter and he's just like,
that's my favorite scene of his.
He like walks out of the theater and this waitress walks up and she's like, how's the pie? And he's just like, so good.
Like, and just, that's how I feel about that performance.
Some strange lines, but you can tell that he's like really leaning into it and like having fun with it. So like I said, I think this is like individually, and I think as a group too, because like in those sequences where Franco and Maguire are supposed to be friends, I buy it a lot more here than I do in any of the other movies. Like even at the end, in the big climax where like Harry shows up to save him and like they have that thing. And I'm like, that I actually buy it this time. Like, I actually believe it. I actually believe that you guys want to help each other and want to have each other's backs.
Or how about the opening action scene of this movie? The first action scene we get is him as Goblin and they're flying through the city. A lot of cool stuff happens there. Mm-hmm. But I just want to jump real quick to the end of that where he gets knocked out. Spider-Man takes him down and Peter is worried that he killed him. Yeah. And Tobey Maguire, some of the best acting he does in the entire trilogy, when he's trying to resuscitate him and do chest compressions. Again, you're buying that history between these characters. Yeah. Even though they're at odds with each other now, they both deeply care about each other.
Right. You realize that there's a lot more going on there. And it like I said, in this movie, I think it actually works.
As far as his lines, I love the so good. But also whenever he's tormenting Peter Parker and he's saying that he's hooked up with MJ now and he goes, that taste. Strawberries.
And he like rubs his lips and like, just really over the top. Like I said, like real like cartoon supervillain stuff. And like you can really tell that he's having a blast with it. And just like just good stuff. So good.
Okay, so that covers two of the three villains. Let's talk about the last one. Topher Grace as Eddie Brock / Venom.
So this, just as I touched on a little bit earlier, this was obviously the most controversial casting decision. This was obviously one that people had hesitation out the gate, because at that point, Topher Grace was just Eric from that 70s show. Like, he was not somebody that was like the cartoon Eddie Brock, obviously, is like an imposing figure. Like, he's supposed to be kind of a bully. That's what Eddie Brock is to a lot of people. And Topher Grace is not that.
They seem to lean more into personality rather than physicality. So his personality is a smart ass, annoying, I mean, demeaning. And that's Topher Grace. That's kind of the shtick that he's known for from that 70s show. Real quick about this guy's name. Did you know his name is Christopher? That's where the name Topher comes from. So also my name, Christopher, and like all the other Christophers, I just cut off the end and go by Chris. This guy cuts off the beginning and goes by Topher.
And well, this is Best of the Rest with Topher Logan. And
Wood, that's so weird. But I get it.
I did not know that. I did not know that. That's genuinely makes sense. But yeah, I guess you got to be different somehow.
Growing up, I mean, there was always like three other Chris's in my class. I mean, it's such a common name. So, hey, Topher Grace, I get
good
it.
Good for you. Wanna,
yeah, good for you, man. So separating how accurate, if you will, it is to the comic book or TV show counterpart, he's doing what's asked of him. He is a smartass. I think as Eddie Brock, I don't really have any complaints about what he does.
No, not really. I think it's really just trying to set it up as like a genuine like mirror image of Peter in a lot of ways, in which case, like not really a hulking, staturing bully type guy, but you know, Spider-Man's got his quips. Eddie's obviously a bit of a smartass. Like they're both photographers. They're both leaning into the same thing. And so
he's a photographer, but he doesn't have the integrity, right? He'll do anything.
He doesn't have the integrity. He very notably gets a staff job at the Daily Bugle by bringing in a doctored photo of Spider-Man stealing some money.
Rather than standing up to JK, he kisses up to him. Yeah.
And he tries to flatter everybody with comments just to get what he wants. And he's watching out for number one pretty much, but doing it in ways that are less than ethical. So he gets busted and that forms his vendetta with Peter. As far as the movie goes, this is kind of like Jim Carrey as the Riddler. What this movie is doing, I think Topher Grace is fine for it. Like we're not presenting, you know, this isn't Tom Hardy. You're not seeing like, you know, some jacked dude who's going to beat you up without the symbiote. You're seeing somebody who's meant to be an analog to Peter in a lot of ways. And I think, and even putting them side by side, Topher Grace is still like significantly taller than Tobey Maguire. Like I like that scene where he like shoves him up against the wall. And I was like, you don't look like you have control of this situation at all. Like he actually is a bigger person than Tobey Maguire, which is interesting. And he did put on like something like over 20 pounds of muscle for this.
Oh, really?
So, like he did the work, like, you know, I just think with him specifically, you're always going to be fighting that 70s show. Like you're always going to be working against that. So I think in regards to the movie itself, I think he works to what it's doing.
Bryce Dallas Howard as Gwen Stacy. This is one of the redheads that is dyed blonde to play Gwen Stacy, right? Very interesting. I think she does a good job here.
Yeah. I think she has better chemistry with Toby than Kirsten Dunst does. And I'm not even saying I think she... like the scene where they're like together, even though he's kind of under the influence of the symbiote, like I actually think it works a little bit better. I think like, and maybe it's just because it's a different take. Maybe it just feels a little bit more fresh, but I think it works a little bit better. And if they had kept this going, I would have been interested in them potentially exploring that. Because this is obviously a bit of the reverse of the comics. Because in the comics, obviously,
Gwen Stacy is first
and is killed by Green Goblin. And then he meets Mary Jane.
Dude,
and
spoilers.
Spoilers for a 60-year-old comic. So with this, obviously, we're playing it a bit differently and introducing Gwen Stacy after the fact. I think she plays it really well. Like, there's a scene, obviously, where Peter is showing off and using Gwen to kind of get back at Mary Jane, even though Mary Jane really hasn't done anything. And, like, there's this, like, and, you know, Gwen is just, like, horrified when she realizes it. She's like, oh, dear God. And so, like, she runs out. She sells it. This is one of those things where I would have liked to have seen more of this. I think there could have been some really interesting stuff done with her as Gwen Stacy if this had continued, which it almost did.
Well, a hallmark of Spider-Man, we talk about how his personal life interferes with his professional life, his life as Spider-Man. A big part of that is juggling romantic love interest. And sometimes it doesn't work out because of Spider-Man. Sometimes he calls it off because he's Spider-Man, but inevitably another girl comes in and. What a hard life this guy has, right? All these girls that,
all
that
these he women. Has to go no, through. No, well, like, because with Mary Jane, you've got the balance of trying to, before she knows he's Spider-Man, and the same with Gwen. Obviously, then there's somebody like Black Cat, who, like, is into him almost solely because he's Spider-Man.
Like the Catwoman-Batman dynamic.
Yeah, like, Black you Cat. Get that dynamic where you've got the women he knows on the side of not being Spider-Man, and then he's got the women that know him because he's Spider-Man. And so it's that romantic tension with all those different people is definitely something that leans into, and they don't go into it too much here. Like, he's still fairly committed to Mary Jane by and large, even in their kind of breakup period. But yeah, I think she's not a whole lot here. She's teased as having some kind of relationship with Eddie Brock, but you're also kind of led to believe that's more in Eddie Brock's head than anything.
You read way too much into it.
Like, yeah, like he tells her dad full on that he's dating her daughter, but then she's like, we had coffee. Like, it's
which they have odd, that yeah. conversation while she's literally hanging,
dying, like in the she's in about danger to die. Of dying.
It's like, hey, by the way, I'm dating your daughter.
And which in the context of this movie is just such an Eddie Brock thing to say. Like, yeah. like just in this moment of trial, he's still the guy that's just like, oh, yeah, I'm dating your super hot daughter. Like,
which the fact that she's the police commissioner's daughter isn't really played into. I mean, they acknowledge really. It as he should be.
They acknowledge it because we obviously get James Cromwell as Captain Stacy here. Yeah. But yeah, they don't really use it too much outside that like one moment where like he sees that it's her and he's like kind of worried. Yeah. Like it's not
he's
a
little
there.
Worried. Ah, Spider-Man, he'll show up, right? That always happens.
Yeah, yeah, it's fine. Obviously, James Cromwell, if we want to talk about him for a little bit, like he's sure. obviously a hugely prolific actor.
Oh, yeah. The dude has a presence. He's got
a
great
face. Not
a whole
lot here, but we've obviously got L.A. Confidential, Babe, Pig in the City, the first Babe. I don't know why I said those backwards.
You were listing them in order of quality. Is that a hot take? Babe 2 is better? I don't know.
I don't know. In hell, he was even recently in Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Like, he's somebody that's continues to work. I remember him, actually. He has a bit part in the... mystery spoof Murder by Death, also shows up in Revenge of the Nerds too randomly, like Revenge
dude's
of the Nerds
dude's been around
well.
Forever he's got yeah,
he's
got
been
a presence.
Making movies since the 70s. He's around.
He doesn't get a ton of screen time, but he's got some important lines because he's relaying to the Parkers that Uncle Ben's killer is possibly still at large, and maybe they right. pinned it on the wrong guy, or at the very least someone else was involved. Of course, we know mm-hmm. that ends up being Sandman, so some pretty important dialogue yep. this guy has to deliver.
He does a good job of pretty much everything he's given, but he's pretty good here too. So,
Rosemary Harris as May Parker, who she is in all three movies, and
she also does, I think deserves a huge shout out for her roles in these. I think she does
absolutely.
A great job.
I don't know if there's any one movie I would give her the Mark Strong Award for, because she's not always super integral to the plot or anything, but she is wonderful. Again,
if it's
the supporting cast is typically outshining the main cast in these movies.
If there's any movie where she might be the MVP, it would probably be Two, but Alfred Molina kind of jumps out at that. But there's sure. She has some really good scenes in Two. But even in this, she's got some great scenes where she talks about just like the idea of commitment and like what it means. Like, because Peter, one of the things he's mulling over in this movie is asking Mary Jane to marry him. So like he talks to Aunt May about it and she gives him her ring and everything. And there's a lot, like you said, a lot of really good little bits there where she gets a chance to really kind of shine. But she's, again, another person who's obviously one of the lesser known people that's across all three movies. But she's a steady hand through all of them. And she's really good at what the role of Aunt May should be. And for a long time, like, this was my idea of Aunt May. It was Rosemary sure. Harris. That's who I had in my head. Not to the point that I don't think anybody else could play it. But and to be fair, they've had some Aunt May's had some stellar castings, like even Sally yeah. Field in the Amazing movies and even Marissa Tomei now
doing something a little different.
They bring in a lot of gravitas. They've obviously people that have like a lot of range and are able to kind of fill that kind of morality play that Aunt May is usually there for, as far as helping people kind of Peter kind of understand the life lesson.
Yeah, she just kind of get younger with each reboot.
Yeah, she's just like, at a certain point, like, that's the joke people were making is that yeah,
Dakota Fanning is Aunt May next time.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we're getting there. But
I think my favorite scene of hers in this one is whenever Peter thinks that he's killed Sandman, who he now knows is responsible for Uncle Ben dying. And he goes and tells Aunt May, hey, did you hear this guy died? Expecting her to be thrilled or relieved, but she's not, and he's a little puzzled about that. And she says, I don't think it's for us to say whether a person deserves to die. Her role in these movies reminds me of Alfred from the Nolan trilogy. He yes. kind of always has the exact right thing to say, sometimes a little too much in those movies, but his role is to provide that morality and keep him from going off the deep end. And she's doing the same thing for Peter Parker, even though she doesn't know he's Spider-Man. But right. she still has the right thing to say that works with whatever dilemma he has going on. And her delivery is fantastic. And I love this woman. That scene and the other scene that really got to me is whenever, you know, we know that she's about to lose the house, but she still gives Peter $20 because he needs it. And she puts it in his hand. She says, and don't try to give that back. Hey, don't leave it. And she's crying as she says it. And I'm crying on my couch watching it. I mean, it really
right.
got
it,
to me.
She reminds me a lot of my grandmother, and I actually mean that in a very in a very positive way. My grandmother's 102.
Wow.
Yeah, my grandmother's old as hell. I don't feel bad saying that because she says it all the time. But she's somebody that's like that. She's very much somebody that would be like, she's somebody that would, I could absolutely see her giving me $20 and just being like, don't give this back to me.
Yeah.
Don't even tell your parents I gave you this. Like that sort of thing with my grandmother, where she's like, I do this, and not to get too personal, I very much hope that I get to see her again before the end.
Sure.
Because 102, you don't even buy green bananas at that point. But it's day by day. You can't take that risk.
Everybody go call your grandma. Tell them you love them.
But no, like, so that very much that sense of like, you know, just being able to sit and like, because what that's kind of a hallmark of Spider-Man stories as well, as kind of how his life as Peter and his life as Spider-Man, while he's facing different issues, the key to them tends to be the same. That kind of, you know, the thing to figure out his relationship with Mary Jane is the same thing he kind of needs to understand for whatever he's dealing with Spider-Man. And so Rosemary Harris is just great at that. And Rosemary Harris is like, she's another person that's like, been around a very long time. Obviously, she's got
Tony Award nominations. She's on TV, film, theater.
I mean, she's 93 alone herself. Like she's still around. And I mean, just television, theater, film, everywhere. She's been in everything. She's done everything. There's an extremely prolific career, and it's she brings a lot to these. And I definitely think she's somebody else that maybe not to the level of like never being able to see someone else in the role again. She's definitely, I would say, in the upper echelon of the casting for these movies.
So revisiting these movies, I'm watching Spider-Man 1, and at the Daily Bugle, I'm like, who is that woman? I recognize that face. And it was Elizabeth Banks. Betty Brant, as J. Jonah Jameson's assistant.
Secretary?
A ton of screen time or anything. I'm like, man, isn't she like way too big for that role? And I guess when Spider-Man 1 was being cast, she wasn't. She had done the greatest comedy of all time, Wet Hot American Summer, but that wasn't a huge hit. I guess it didn't really propel into stardom, but she's done a ton of stuff since then. I think by the time you get to Spider-Man 3, she's a little bit outgrown that role, but she does. I like her time she's on screen. In this one, they kind of start to maybe hint that there could in the future be something between her and Peter Parker. Whenever Peter gets kind of his swagger, there's a little bit of chemistry between the two of them. And something this series does a really good job of is building this world and laying down the foundation for things to come in the future. Now we know it stops here at Spider-Man 3, but had he got a Spider-Man 4 and they did bring, you know, make something romantic between Betty and Peter, it wouldn't feel out of nowhere because she's been around since day one.
And then even just some of the other stuff, like obviously like Dylan Baker as Kurt Connors is somebody who recurs in all of these films. And he's a guy that in this movie is looking over the symbiote for Peter. But even then, like, you've now built in that character. If you want to go the lizard route, you've got that built in as well. And like, it's because Spider-Man is a deep world. There's a lot going on there. There's a lot to do there.
You know, it's a little bit different. We, you know, of course you got the MCU, which connects everything. And we've talked about X-Men, where that cast is so big, it could be its own universe. Uh-huh. With Spider-Man, you've only got, well, you could have multiple heroes, but even if you just have Spider-Man as the hero, the supporting cast and the villains is so deep that you can build this huge world. And they were doing a very good job doing that. But you look at, we have what, 8 Spider-Man movies now. There's 7 that are live action. And then you've got Into the Spider-Verse. Only one villain has been repeated. Isn't that incredible?
What villain has been repeated?
New Green Goblin. Harry as Goblin happens in Amazing Spider-Man 2 and this movie.
Oh, yes. But either way, yeah, you're right.
But other than that, it's a new villain, and they're always high profile villains that everybody knows.
And that's actually something I liked about Batman Begins, is that Batman Begins made the I don't know if it was a conscious decision, but they used villains that weren't in the Burton and Schumacher movies. So they specifically, even decade plus later almost, were like, we're going to use 2 new guys.
Yeah.
And like I said, I can't say if that was a deliberate choice for like, we really don't want to use them, or if it just worked for that movie. But like you said, it's a deep universe, and to have that ability is good.
As much as I love Batman and his rogues gallery, by the time you get to the 6th Batman movie, you're redoing the Joker, you're redoing Two-Face, and then the next movie you do Bane, which we've seen, and Catwoman, which we've seen. And now
there was a lot of recycling at that
point. We got Penguin coming up, whereas, like I said, Spider-Man is
We got Penguin, we got Riddler, we got a whole bunch coming up. So it's,
yeah.
And even the thing I like about, like you said, just even looking into the MCU movies, we're still like trying to find new people. And like the Keaton as Vulture in Homecoming and then Gyllenhaal as Mysterio, like those are not just new villains. They're like great castings and great performances. Like Keaton owns that role as Vulture and it's just awesome. So yeah, just to have that deep of a universe is always going to be impressive. And it's something about Spider-Man I think people don't necessarily realize is that it really is that deep.
I heard it pitched one time, you know, people talk about Marvel and DC crossing over, which they've kind of done before, but not too deep. But one of the best pitches I've ever heard was to have Spider-Man go against Batman Rogues Gallery and Batman go against Spider-Man, because they both have such a deep one that there's a lot of cool matchups you could do with that.
Oh, yeah. Those two are probably the most prolific Rogues Galleries in comics.
There's villains that are as big as the hero, which is pretty hard to do.
And not just villains, but like villains you consider A-list. Mm-hmm. Like, because like with Superman, you've got like two or three villains that are sitting at the top. Like you got Lex Luthor, Brainiac, and General Zod. With Spider-Man and Batman, you've specifically got easily 6 to 8 villains that can all be considered A-list. And it's not very common.
They get their own book sometimes, and
yeah,
they're not bad. All right, so let's talk about this movie. What do you think, when is this movie firing on all cylinders? What's the high point for you? What is your favorite scene in this movie?
There's probably that scene we touched on earlier where, like, you mentioned that the best fight scenes are when Spider-Man and Sandman are fighting each other one-on-one. That chase sequence where, like, he's robbing the armored cars and him and Spider-Man have that face-off and it's, like, the first time we're really seeing them fight each other. I think that, to me, might be my favorite scene. There's other stuff I like, but I think that's the one where like we're really dialed into like the essence of like what I kind of see a Spider-Man fight as. We've got a new villain that he's not faced before. And even like the scene at the end where like he takes his mask off and there's sand in it. He takes off his boot and there's all this sand in it. It's just like,
where do these guys come from?
like exactly. Like even though to this point he's not faced that many people. But no, it's that scene, I think, is just kind of quintessential. Like, it feels like Spider-Man to me. Like, that feels like an issue of the comic.
Yeah, the cops are involved, which is a big part of Spider-Man being in New York. And, you know, the cops are chasing. Spider-Man jumps in. There's always citizens around in these movies, which I like. I think there's kind of a mixed reception to that. But you've got New Yorkers always kind of standing around, and you cut back to them for reaction shots and stuff. But Spider-Man, he's the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, the city. Just like Batman, the city is a big part of who this character is, and they incorporate that a lot. This chase scene is a great example of that. This movie has some great action. It looks great. It looks expensive. One thing we haven't talked about is the budget of this movie. It definitely cleared $300 million. It's hard to kind of track down where that is, but at the time it was released, it was the most expensive movie ever made. I believe the one right before this was X-Men 3. It had to have been, because X-Men 3 came out right before this, right?
I think Pirates, whatever, the At World's End. I think that took it after X-Men, and then Spider-Man took it after that. So it's definitely, like you said, there was a string of there where, like, apparently even Superman Returns was considered one of the most expensive movies ever made at a time. But apparently that 2006 or 2007 superhero movie run, just it's all really expensive, apparently.
But it shows. It looks good. And you still got a good mix of practical and CG, which is something that I champion. It's something that like to see. You know, you do what the situation calls for. Going back to Spider-Man 1 and Spider-Man 2, I feel like the technology wasn't quite there for some of the stuff they tried to do. And it's one of my complaints with those movies. There's times when you get a full CG double and it's usually obvious because they don't move like a regular human. Uh-huh. And they do that a lot here too, but they hide it a lot more. They use it less. They do things like they put the actor's actual face onto the head of the CG body just to blend it in a lot better.
Uh-huh.
And that's why this period of movies, you constantly have that record being broken of most expensive movie ever made, because they're literally developing technology that's never been done before. So even though you've got bigger movies later on, because all this technology was already made and its computers have gotten better, it costs less to do it. But, you know, first one through the wall gets the bloody nose, right?
Right. The one thing I do like a lot in this movie, and I noticed it with those effects, is that you would actually be able to blend, like, you would have like a CG sequence that would like seamlessly flow into a live action sequence. And that happened a couple of times where like I was actually very impressed, because like it's a scene like in the big final fight where like it's Sandman and Spider-Man and Venom are like all flying around. And then like he like flies off to the side and like lands on the steel post. And then at that point, like mid flight almost, it looks like it switches back to live action.
Yeah. And but just, it's seamless. Like you said,
it's they're updating it. They're building this technology like in real time. They're learning how to do it. And some of it looks really great here. Obviously, like the CG here, I think looks the least dated, which it should because it's the most recent one of these. But it, yeah, I was actually fairly impressed with a lot of that stuff.
Another thing, during when I was rewatching Spider-Man 1, they do something that I really don't like. That it's whenever Spider-Man like climbs a wall for the first time, he's wearing his wrestling gear and it's a full CG Peter Parker. When it's the easiest to tell whenever you can still see their skin because it's very hard to replicate. But right. It's very simple. He just climbs a wall and he's chasing after the robber, but it's full CG and the camera just goes nuts. It's like spinning around him as he climbs the wall. He reaches the rooftop and it does another spin. It does impossible camera moves that you couldn't do practically, which is, in my opinion, always a big no-no. It takes you right out of it because you just know what you're seeing isn't real, and it really highlights that. And Spider-Man 2 does a much better job, as well as this one, of keeping the camera real. Now, when he's swinging and stuff, it's certainly zipping around with him. That maybe isn't quite possible, but it's not going over the top. It's not spinning. It doesn't go circles around him. It just keeps up with the pace and just works a lot better. I really like, speaking how they implement the real life actors with the CG, during that first fight with Goblin, one of the kind of side stories that's happening during that chase is Peter has the ring that he's going to give MJ in his pocket, and he keeps losing track of it. And there's one part where he almost drops it. And the ring comes close to the camera and he's reaching out to it. And it's the real actor, because you've got to have the real reaction for that, for almost losing the ring. And it's a nice little touch. I think they made the right decision for incorporating the real actor. Now I just want to take a look at this list because it's so much fun. This movie, when it comes out in 2007, most expensive movie ever made. As of now, it's ranked number 15, which in that short amount of time has dropped that far. I'm going to run through them real fast.
14 years,
Most expensive movie ever made as of right now, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides.
Which only comes out 4 years after this.
Isn't that crazy?
So for 10 years, we've had the same movie be the most expensive movie of all time.
Is that Pirates actually 4?
I think it's 4. Yeah, it's 4.
I lose track after 3. Okay. And then number 2, Avengers Age of Ultron, Avengers Endgame, Avengers Infinity War.
It's insane to me that Age of Ultron costs more than Endgame and Infinity War separately.
Endgame is pretty close. Ultron's 365, Endgame is 356, and that is interesting.
Yeah.
And then number 5, you got Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. This list I'm looking at has it tied with Justice League. They've got to only be talking about theatrical Justice League,
right? Because if you include the Snyder stuff, you're actually getting closer to 400 million.
I think it's number one.
You could probably make the argument that Zack Snyder's Justice League is the most expensive film of all time.
Number 7, Solo, a Star Wars movie, and Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker. A lot of these are not surprises. Avengers movies, of course, you got a big cast, you got special effects. Pirates, sure. Number 9, John Carter.
Which, I love John Carter. If we ever want to talk about that movie on the show, I'd be glad to do it. But
I've never
for
seen
a movie that is, like, obviously you're taking a very old property. That was an adaptation of the old Edgar Rice Burroughs, John Carter, of Mars novels, The Princess of Mars, Everything of Mars, Chessmen of Mars, all that.
Ghost of Mars.
Yes, exactly. The unknown later installment. But like, first off, calling it John Carter makes it sound like it's like a lawyer movie. Like it just doesn't some movie about like some historical drama. It's very odd that for what could are, it was very much an obscure film. Like I love the books, but I would never say that like there's something people were chomping at the bit for to make that movie. So expensive. Like, use $264 million to make a John Carter movie just seems so weird to me. And like I said, I'm a guy who likes it. I'm an apologist for it. But like, it's like, you probably should have made that for $100 million less. Like, it very much would have helped you.
It might sound weird, but I almost feel bad for Taylor Kitsch. Is that how I say his name? Because he gets to play Gambit, which is a character that I love, in a movie that is Pan.
Not good.
And then he gets this huge role as John Carter in a movie that is just known for how much money that it lost. And then I haven't heard from the guy since then. So I'm sure he's happy. I'm sure he has a good life. He's made a ton of money, but I kind of feel
for him. He was in True Detective season 2. So it just continued. He was in the season that wasn't as good as season 1.
The one that nobody likes.
And then he was also in, there was something else I saw him in recently, but it was another one where I was like, what could have been?
Number 10, Batman v Superman. Number 11, Star Wars Last Jedi. Number 12, Tangled and the Lion King, the remake, of course. Number 14, Star Wars The Force Awakens. And then, yeah, we're down to Spider-Man 3. So that's an interesting list. Yeah.
But yeah, some interesting stuff on there. Like, I didn't realize Tangled was so expensive.
I don't know why, but I do know why. I bet it's the hair. Because it's insane.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. I could do it. Yeah. The rest of this list is a lot of stuff that's not super surprising. Stuff like Spectre, Dark Knight Rises. Yeah. But yeah. So either way, Spider-Man 3, extremely expensive.
Very expensive movie, but it looks good. It shows. As far as action scenes, I'm going to agree with you that I think the high point is when he's fighting Sandman. I like that chase. I also like whenever he's wearing the black suit and they face off in the sewer. There's a super cool shot where he's stalking him and you can kind of see him in the shadows and then he hides. Sandman looks back. They end up fighting. He finds out that he is weak to water. I really like the scene where he's pulling the pipe open and as the rivets of the pipe are busting off, the camera zooms in a little bit more each time.
Oh yeah,
on Sandman. Yeah, it's kind of corny and campy, but it's what Raimi does well, and it's effective. But as far as my overall favorite scene, what I am going to go with is the dinner scene where Peter Parker is planning to propose.
Great scene, great
top scene. To bottom. Love. So the scene starts with Bruce Campbell at his best cameo of the
best
trilogy.
Best cameo of all of them. This is including the one where he named Spider-Man.
Yeah. He's usually kind of a jerk to Spider-Man, but in this one, he's actually really nice to him.
He's like, he's like on his side.
He's got the thick French accent. Andrew, I sent you a picture because I rewatched this scene doing some notes and stuff and I had subtitles on. And anytime he speaks French, the subtitles just say speaking French. Yeah, which the spirit did the same thing when I did that. I don't know.
I love when movies like don't even bother to try to do it. They're just like, he's talking French. We guess. We assume.
But of course, with that thick accent, he calls Peter Pecker.
But that's what they said. Pecker.
I really love, he shows him the ring and he goes, oh, and he puts on his glasses.
Pulls out his glasses.
And he goes, like, he taps on it and he goes, hello.
Yeah. And then I love he like gives it, he's like, and if the musicians could play this song, and he's like, their favorite.
yeah, which I don't even like, know what like, the song like, is. But
like, I don't think they even show it. But like,
he's super enthusiastic about it.
He's very enthusiastic about it. He's very into it. And he sells it. Like you said, it's very ridiculous. It's very over the top. But like, it works for the scene. It works for the setup. Like, it's not, it all works for me. It's very cool. Very
what they come up with is, they're going to bring the champagne out with the ring and the champagne glass. And so Peter sits down and before MJ arrives, he's going through it in his head. And it's one of my favorite Tobey Maguire moments because he's just going, oh, how'd that get there? Oh, don't cry. Just what he thinks is going to happen.
He's like talking through the conversation in his head, just how he thinks it's going to go. Yeah.
And what I love about this is the conflict really comes to a head because Mary Jane has lost her role on Broadway, but hasn't had a chance to tell Peter yet because he's so wrapped up being Spider-Man. So she comes in really down and he doesn't really understand or make any attempt to see things from her point of view because she's saying she's not feeling well emotionally. And he's like, no, I get it. You're a big star. I'm something of an icon now. And he's saying
big star myself.
And it works. And of course, Gwen Stacy comes in and is a little flirtatious with Peter.
Right.
Just a few scenes ago, we saw Peter as Spider-Man do the upside down kiss on a stage with Gwen Stacy. So Mary Jane is already, of course, a little ticked off about that. As you said, Gwen Stacy and Tobey Maguire, Gwen Stacy and Peter Parker have very good chemistry with each other. And it shows here. She asked for that picture of them kissing. And I love this line. She goes, who gets kissed by Spider-Man? And it's Kirsten Dunst's single best line. She just goes, I can't imagine. And just the look on her face is fantastic.
The face of betrayal.
It's good.
That scene is actually really good. And like, for some reason in these movies, I tend to forget about the smaller scenes being just as important, because this is the scene that like takes the kind of metaphorical rift between Peter and MJ and makes it like a real rift, like takes it from being Peter is kind of oblivious that they're drifting apart to be like, all right, we are apart.
I mean, he goes into that scene prepared to propose and she leaves, goes in and leaves. Dumped. Yeah,
like
exactly. She tells him not to follow him. I love, and you know, I watched all three movies and I've shared my thoughts about the performances in the previous two, but in this one, this is when I really realized like, man, they're doing something different in this movie. They are bringing it to a whole other level. Whenever she calls him out for kissing Gwen Stacy.
Yeah.
And she asks, you know, was that Peter Parker? Was that Spider-Man? And he's like, I don't know what you mean. She's like, yes, you do. That was our kiss. And she's so hurt and angry, and she relays it all in that scene.
And it just sells the disconnect too.
Yeah.
So.
After she storms off, she says, don't follow me. A running bit throughout the scene is every time he waves his hand, they're about to bring out the champagne and Bruce Campbell has to go, oh, yes, no, and cancel fast.
No, yeah.
So finally, they bring out the champagne after she stormed off. And Andrew, I got to ask you this. He gets the champagne glass, it's got her ring, and he grabs a fork to fish it out. And it makes me wonder, what's the plan? I see this happen all the time in movies, right? They bring the ring out in the champagne glass. Is she supposed to see it at the bottom of the glass? And does she end up pulling it out with a fork? Is she supposed to drink it and it slides into her mouth? And she goes, oh, what's this?
She's actually supposed to ingest it.
I'm going to propose to you tomorrow morning after your coffee.
Yes. It's an ancient ritual that we look at to really explore how deeply you're committed as a couple. Like how far can you really say? No, I've always assumed the idea is to, again, just kind of fish it out with a fork, but like you're so supposed romantic. To like just notice it. Like, and it's just like, just imagine it like gets stuck down there. Just like, Jesus.
I don't know, but I'm not faulting this movie for it. Because like I said, it's a Hollywood thing. It's certainly happened in other movies, but yeah, that scene top to bottom, everyone's killing it. We are kind of dancing around, pun intended, a certain scene in this movie, but up through most of this movie, I'm just loving every decision that they're making, and it's firing on all cylinders. Even though I would say ultimately the high point of the series is probably Spider-Man 2. I think most people would agree with that. There are high points of the series in this movie. And as far as their personal relationship, it doesn't get any better in any of the three movies than that scene.
Well, and I can agree, because I think what's interesting is like the sequence where like he goes full symbiote is also so late in this movie. Like you get well over half the movie that's essentially just this interpersonal drama between all of them, with Eddie Brock as like a supporting character. And like, and I think that's what makes this movie a little bit different. Like the Sandman threat is fairly minor. Like kind of what keeps happening with him is like, he goes, then something happens to him that kind of sidelines him, and then he builds himself back up, and then he gets sidelined again. And like it kind of keeps that, like he gets his Dr. Manhattan moment kind of right at the beginning where like he gets ripped apart and then kind of forces himself back together. And then he has a couple of scenes where he gets wet and falls apart.
Let's talk about that first scene really quick. Now, first off, it seems, look, he's running from the cops. He stumbles upon an experiment of some kind. He becomes a Sandman. It does not get to the science of it, whatever. He becomes Sandman, but the particle effects, that's got to be one reason this movie was so expensive, because
some of that stuff is really good.
Literally individual grains of sand, it all looks great. It doesn't look dated, it holds up. But that first time that he forms himself, and the music just is,
oh, it's so good.
It's relaying the tragedy of what's happened to him, and the locket in the sand, and he can't grab it at first because he's falling apart.
That is because they give him a very kind of tragic Mr. Freeze-esque backstory here, where the whole reason he's basically a criminal is because he's trying to get money because his daughter is sick. That's the whole motivation for him being a criminal. There's nothing else to it. He's not some guy that's just bad. He's only in these bad circles because he desperately needs money so badly. And so throughout this movie and like his like transformation, like he escapes from prison and the first place he goes is to go see his daughter.
Yeah,
like
just to see her.
First place, just to see her. And then he's like, I'm going to get the money. He's like, I'm going to find the money. And his ex-wife or who was, you know, whatever, is skeptical. She's like, you can't just keep coming back around and saying you're going to do this. And so his rivalry with Spider-Man is just that Spider-Man keeps stopping him from stealing money. Like, that's it. Like, that's really all his vendetta is. And so he ends up teaming up with Venom in the end because they need Spider-Man out of the way. But just every sequence specifically, where like the locket and he can't hold it. Yeah. And then like even when he get like Spider-Man thinks he kills him later, it's the locket again that's like on his hand. That's like the thing that like allows him to be tangible. It's the thing that elects.
It's literally like his will to live and what's literally holding him together.
And you buy it, and Hayden Church sells it too. Like it really does work, and it's very, very well done. And it actually is kind of a shame that he's not a bigger presence. But at the same time, with the way you're playing the character, he's not really somebody I think you can make like a Doc Ock level villain for the film, because when you've got that tragic backstory kind of being driven by that, you don't want to go too hard, because then you have to just find a point where you just turn him into a full villain. But because he's so secondary, all the other cast members are just given time to dig into their own stuff. And I think that's why, oddly, I think the first half of this movie does succeed so well. And then the second half, and how it's not even really the second, it's like the last third. Just so much happens in the last like third of this movie. There's just
one thing the movie does get knocked for inevitably is that it's bloated and there's too much going on, which I'm not saying that's wrong, but I think the movie does a very good job juggling things, and whether or not it sticks the landing, we'll get to, but certainly through the first half of this movie and beyond that, like I said, it's more than half the movie. It's doing a very good job, and it's very smart. As you know, getting amnesia, is that lazy? I don't know, but it's a way to get this storyline sidelined to focus on this. And then while they're focusing on this, this happened. Early in the movie, we get introduced to the Venom before it attaches to a suit and becomes part of him. But the movie definitely shifts between these storylines in a pretty organic way.
Yeah, say pretty and deft way. Yeah.
Nothing gets like, I won't say nothing, but most things don't get shortchanged and they get their time to shine. And I think it does a good job with that. You read about the kind of the behind the scenes, the studio wanted this character, Raimi wanted this character, and they just had to kind of make it all happen and cause some rifts between Raimi and the studio that ultimately ended this franchise. Given all the things that he had to squeeze in there, I think you do about as good of a job as you can, at least through most of the movie.
I think the movie builds Venom as the perfect villain for the next movie. I think the issues come from trying to not just give Peter the symbiote and get rid of the symbiote and then give it to Eddie and then turn Eddie into the final villain. It's too much. It's too much all at once. And I think that's where it falters a bit. But I think everything up to like Peter ripping off the suit, up to that point, I'm mostly with what's happening. Like he finally pushed, like everything seems to go wrong. He leans into the black suit. He's hamming it up. He's living it up. He's having a good time.
Let's talk about Peter wearing this black suit, because he does it twice. The first time is an accident because the symbiote attaches to him while he's sleeping in his Spider-Man suit, as you do. And he wakes up on the side of a building, not sure what's going on, but he feels this new power. And he becomes much more aggressive and angry and not himself. He takes things too far. He, even as Peter Parker, he's more aggressive. I really like the scene when his landlord keeps pestering him for rent. And he says, "You'll get your rent when you fix this damn door." And it's not hokey or anything. It's angry Peter Parker. And I like that. And I love the landlord's reaction, because he says,
this is great too.
He says he's a good boy. He must be in some kind of trouble. He's not like mad at him. He doesn't yell back. He's like, "Whoa, this is out of character." And he cares for the guy.
It's another like Jameson type moment where you've got this character, because this guy also shows up in all these movies, I think.
He starts in two.
So he's another guy that's like portrayed as like very in your face, aggressive person, kind of a prick. And then like in this moment, you kind of realize that, oh, he actually does kind of care about him.
It's a good moment.
And I think they have another moment later.
He gives him advice because he's waiting by the phone. If he wants to call Mary Jane, he's like, "Oh, just call the girl." And he tries to give him advice. It's not Aunt May level, but
that scene too, where he's like, "He's a good boy. He must be in some kind of trouble." Like that was
very good.
I like that. That was another good little peek beneath the scene moment where you kind of see there's more to it than you realize.
So let's talk about the second time that he wears the black suit. He fights Sandman. He thinks he kills him. He goes, has that talk with Aunt May, like we talked about. But notoriously, there's also these scenes as Peter Parker, and Peter Parker's got a new attitude. and a new swagger.
Mm-hmm.
Rewatching this, he's walking down the sidewalk. He's snapping his fingers. He's doing his thing. And there's a couple people reacting like, who is this guy? He's kind of goofy. And I was like, did I misread this scene the first time? Like, does the movie know that he's goofy and hokey? But there's other times when characters are like, yeah, this guy is cool. And they're all on board. So I don't know exactly how we're supposed to feel about it.
There's like two scenes almost back to back. One where he's walking down the street and women are all giving him like sultry looks. They're like looking at him like they're like, oh, wow, look at you. Then there's a scene later where they're looking at him and they're like looking at him like, wow, what a dork. Like it's almost two scenes back to back where there's two like polar opposite reactions. And it's just very strange.
It is. And this is the part where I'm like, you know, who wrote this? How old are they? Kind of fellow kids moment. Because again, as Black Suit Spider-Man or Peter Parker, he says, I'm going to put some dirt in your eye and some other stuff. Oh, he says, well, you going to cry talking to Harry Osborn, which is just
Goblin Jr. going to cry.
Such an old school bully kind of thing. Yeah. So I don't quite understand what they were going for. There's a scene where he gets new clothes and he walks out of the store and he does the hip thrust and everything.
Yeah.
And my wife's watching. And she's like, wait a minute. And I think she's going to say, this is what they're referencing in Spider-Verse, because they mock this moment. But she goes, that's Joaquin Phoenix as the Joker on the stairs. The same dance. And they're very similar. I'm reminded of all those memes where they splice them together. But I was like,
you're not wrong.
I like, there's the scene in the jazz club with the movie. I mean, they just go all in for better.
They go all in at this point.
And I can't say that I'm feeling it whenever he's playing the song and dancing and stuff, but I like the story that they're telling. You alluded to it earlier. He's with Gwen Stacy and ultimately he just wants to make Mary Jane feel bad. And when Gwen Stacy realizes that, she storms out, she apologizes. She's horrified. To MJ. Yeah. And then Peter Parker confronts MJ and he even gets aggressive and hits her and realizes that he's gone too far.
Yeah.
That stuff works. What they're trying to say works. Even if you're not feeling with how they're saying it, I get that. It's not like a pointless scene though.
Right.
And this movie's reputation, it's all about these scenes. Dottie mentioned, you know, Spider-Verse makes fun of it. Whenever people were talking about this movie when they first came out, they're like, this is the scene that they're referencing, right?
Yeah. This whole 10-minute sequence is basically the whole reason people hate this movie, seemingly.
Yes. And there's great stuff otherwise.
Yeah.
I mean, when this movie's not working, it's not working fine. But when it is working, it is some of the best Spider-Man of the entire trilogy.
I agree. And like I said, I think the scene after he takes the symbiote off, I think that's really when the movie just goes into overdrive. And that's when it's trying to fit in it's trying to do too much.
Yeah, during the finale, like they cram a lot in there, and the movie's lost me a little bit by some of the decisions. So I'm a little checked out, but I don't hate everything that happens in the finale.
By no means.
It feels a little rushed.
There's some cool stuff. Like I actually like the moment when Harry comes and saves him in that final fight, and like they grab hands and they're like, it works for me. Like you get Harry showing up because Harry has spent the last movie and a half believing that Spider-Man killed his father, and then his loyal lifelong butler finally reveals to him for some reason years later that he's, you know, he says, like, he tells him very clearly, is like, your father's wounds were from his own glider. He died by his own hand. Now I don't know why the wounds being from the glider means he died by his own hand.
I don't know
that
why he waited 5 years or
yeah why he waited so long. But but at that moment Harry kind of realizes that he's like, no, my anger's in the wrong place. And so Harry shows up to save him, and they have this kind of like tag team construction site death match where it's Venom and Sandman versus a new Goblin and Spider-Man. And there's just some stuff there where, like, again, you buy that friendship, you buy that they're trying to work together. You realize that Harry knows he's got to do the right thing now. And a lot of that works for me. Like there's some cool sequences there.
I like how the news is kind of narrating it, and they have a real news anchor.
That's the first time I saw that guy's face. I was like, is that Jerry Springer? Like it looked kind of like him. I was like, that's weird. But like literally they're like narrating news, reporting the fight in like real time. Like,
there's a crowd like watching
with it.
There's that fun scene with J. Jonah Jameson buying the camera off the little girl.
Parker.
$100.
And the film costs extra.
Yeah, it was good. There's fun stuff throughout there.
There's some good stuff
It's the least interesting Sandman. I don't like giant Sandman.
Yeah.
Doesn't do much for me, especially compared to the other Sandman fights. But then we eventually finally get a Venom fight. He takes him down because he learns that, you know, he had learned earlier with the bell that he reacts negatively.
He actually doesn't learn that earlier. That's what I thought was interesting, is the scene at the end makes it sound like the bell was coincidence, because at that moment, all the pipes drop and he sees Venom react to it. And that he draws the line that it's the sound that does it, which makes him going to the church a little bit strange, because you thought that was the whole reason he went there. But obviously Sandman kind of gets taken out by Harry. Harry goes and tries to help Peter and he gets kind of thrown to the side. But then that's when he realizes the sound is what does it. And it's a pretty cool sequence. I kind of like how it all works and comes together.
I like how it ends with he finally gets the symbiote off of him, but Brock loved how he felt. And so as he's destroying it, he jumps into it and they both get destroyed. I like that as a story arc. Like, we don't like all the decisions that they made about Venom, but as an Eddie Brock storyline, if you're going to wrap it up, I think it wraps it up fine. And that's all we got here. We got wrap up after wrap up after wrap up. He goes and has a heart to heart with Sandman, who by this point he knows is the one who actually killed his Uncle Ben. But he sort of learns in this movie that things just aren't so black and white. He didn't do it in cold blood, and Peter Parker forgives him in a very powerful scene. And Hayden Church, as well as Tobey Maguire, do a great job during the speech. And in the end, it's a little strange that Sandman kind of gets away.
It's interesting because when Peter goes to Aunt May and says that, like, you know, it's not our choice to make, the lesson Peter is trying to learn here, I think, is that just because someone has done bad things does not make them a bad person. I think, because that's the lesson he has to learn about himself. It's like, you know, obviously the symbiote made him do some bad things.
As Zangief would later say, just because you're a bad guy doesn't mean you're a bad guy.
Exactly. Thank you, Zangief. So I think grappling with that and kind of looking and understanding that, especially in Sandman's case, like, there was no intention to kill his uncle and it was an accident. But that accident is now all his life is. And I think Peter, to be able to let go of that, is meant to kind of reflect that lesson of himself. And then that last scene with Mary Jane, they're not back together. They're not engaged. They're not anything. It's just Peter going to see her perform at the jazz club. And I think subtle things like that, I like that it's not, didn't try to shotgun Peter and Mary Jane
wedding.
All of a sudden, like, after our shared trauma of watching Harry die, because Harry sacrifices himself at one point to save Peter from Venom, I like that they didn't shotgun it, that they didn't try to force it back. And even, like you said, now you're opening up the possibility of other things, because if they're still broken up and it's more just like a mutual understanding at this point, you've got Gwen Stacy, you've got Betty Brant, you've got now places to go, that this movie actually left it in a fairly interesting place for Spider-Man 4. Like, you actually had some interesting places you could go.
Yes. And before we get into the potential Spider-Man 4, let's talk a little bit about Harry Osborn dying, because, like I said, it's wrap up after wrap up after wrap up. And I got a little bit of a chuckle because after his conversation with Sandman, they're on a construction site. There's literally, he's on one floor and Sandman flies away and then he does his web and he just lowers himself down to the next floor. And it's like, all right, that's wrapped up. Let's go.
Now let's go.
Harry. Hey guys. Yeah. Harry's like, oh, I've been waiting for you. I can tie now, but it's a powerful scene. You got three of them together. And one of my complaints about Tobey Maguire is his face work. It's a little strange, but he gives it his all. He cries. It's a little over the top, but hey, maybe Tobey Maguire just an ugly crier, and that was genuine. I don't know, but it worked. My daughter was like sobbing during this. I mean, this is totally got her.
Well, it really, like I said, it ties into this one really selling it, because like they really just, it's not just that they reconcile. It's like they finally realize that, like, I think they may even say like best friends. Like they're not just friends, but they've always been great friends, and a lot of that works for me, and I like it. I think it works well, and I think it sells that this is something that's truly devastating for Peter.
Harry's got a good 3-movie arc.
After spending so much time as adversaries and having a brief moment of being friends again, thinking that just maybe it doesn't have to go back to the way it was, to having it go back, and then to seemingly finally actually getting past it, just to have it taken from you again. It's a very powerful arc that I think Toby sells well. And it's good stuff.
Now, as you mentioned, there were plans for a Spider-Man 4, so much there that were. they had an outline. They had plans for Anne Hathaway to be Black Cat. They had plans for possibly Bruce Campbell to have a bigger role as Mysterio. There were some legit contracts drawn up and everything.
I think John Malkovich was in talks for Vulture.
Which, that's cool casting. I would love to see that.
Yeah. So it was interesting because this was something that they were talking about for a long time, and then just kind of very abruptly in January 2010 announced it was done and they were going with
Amazing Spider-Man reboot.
The Amazing Spider-Man reboot.
There's a lot of things that play into it. I feel like being on who you ask, they'll tell you why Spider-Man 4 never happened or why the series was canceled. It's just, I think it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I think the backlash to this movie, Sam Raimi said that he just would not feel comfortable making the deadline they wanted because all Sony cares about is a new Spider-Man movie. They don't care if it's a reboot, if it's a different actor, if it's a different director. This franchise makes money. Even now with the Tom Holland Spider-Man movies, they've got a every 2 year schedule. And so, yeah, Spider-Man 4 is not going to happen. You can't make the deadline. Hey, let's reboot it. So all those things, all those factors come together to in this franchise with what we got here at number 3. But there was plenty of thread you could have picked up on for Spider-Man 4 and beyond. I mean, they had plans for 5 and 6 even, outlined and laid out. But
yep. I mean, this is something that, like you said, there was a deep cast of characters, and who knows, with some of what we're hearing about Far From Home, maybe this isn't as dead as we thought. But
yeah, maybe some of the threads can be picked back up, crazy enough.
A little bit of webbing they can work with there. But
hey.
But no,
Andrew, this is no time for puns.
I know. but no, this is a movie I didn't have a bad time watching this. I think what's the nice way to put this? I think there were some,
there's just some decisions
that don't work. I think the Eddie Brock direction was something that people just didn't really jibe with. I think
we haven't talked too much about him when he's actually Venom. He pulls his face is revealed a lot, and he's got some truly gross lines with my spider sense is tingling, if you know what I mean.
He grabs Mary Jane and he's like, my spider sense. Yeah, that sequence. And it's weird because the whole vendetta between Peter and Brock is born out of the fact that Eddie is thrown out of the Bugle disgraced because Peter reveals this picture that he sent in. It was a fake.
Yeah.
And it makes the Daily Bugle has to print a retraction, and it makes it all look dumb, makes him look dumb. So his whole, to the point that he goes to church and asks God to kill Peter Parker. So the whole vendetta is just based off that humiliation. And so that's the goal of Venom, is he just wants to humiliate Peter. Doesn't he make it sound like he wants to kill it? Just makes it sound like he wants to humiliate him, which I guess in his mind might be killing him. But I can't say, they do show his face a lot. You actually don't get a whole lot of shots of just straight Venom face.
You really don't. They're very fleeting.
You get more of Topher's face with his weird teeth. Yeah. Apparently the symbiote for him went on his teeth. but there's definitely some decisions there that I think were polarizing. And I can't say that that's an invalid thing to be. I don't think you're wrong for not enjoying that and thinking that it definitely impacts the film.
It doesn't ruin the movie for me. When I logged this on my letterbox, I put a heart next to it. I liked the movie. If I was a critic, and I had to submit to Rotten Tomatoes, thumbs up, thumbs down, I would still say thumbs up. I acknowledge those issues, but ultimately I enjoy the movie.
It was definitely something that I hadn't watched in a long time. Yeah. Overall, I like what happens here for the most part. I do.
Yeah.
I do get a little bummed out that Hayden Church is so minimal. It feels like he's definitely somebody that could have given a lot more. But at the same time, I think with the story they were telling, Spider-Man villains, you tend to get a lot of people that all hate Spider-Man personally, which is why it's so easy for them to team up. But with this, you very much have a lot of different shades of gray. And I definitely think that's something the movie tries to explore, is the idea of shades of gray and the idea that things are maybe not as black and white as you think they are. Obviously with Peter, he realizes the guy that stumbled out the window in Spider-Man 1 didn't shoot his uncle. Still a bad guy, but not the one that shot his uncle. He finds out that Marco did shoot his uncle, but it was an accident. He himself is pushed to troubling limits and realizes that he's gone too far, but realizes also that he can't necessarily come back from those. Those are decisions he has to live with. And Harry, realizing that his father is not the man he thought he was, and also realizing that the anger he's taking out on Peter has been completely misplaced. Misguided. So like, yep. Everybody gets these little moments where they're forced to like grapple with some notion that things are not what they seem. And like, even Mary Jane, even in that aftermath of that proposal scene, she comes to check in on Peter when she finds out that they realize his uncle's killer is still out there. And it's not about dinner. It's just about checking in on Peter. Yeah. It's a very good scene. You never hear anybody talk about that. You never hear anybody talk about the nuance of looking at the fact that there's these shades of gray.
Yeah. Rewatching the Spider-Man movies and the X-Men movies in these past few weeks, I was reminded about how small Stan Lee's cameos used to be. Sometimes
it's literally just blink and you'll miss it.
Exactly. And this movie changes that. I'm probably the first time he has such a predominant cameo, and it's really good. I mean, it really breaks your immersion. The movie kind of stops, and what he does doesn't really fit with the movie, but no one cares because it's Stan Lee.
Right.
But he's looking up at a picture of Spider-Man and he goes, you know, I guess one person can make a difference. Enough said. And I don't think it was the intention at the time, but looking at it now, he's talking about himself. And that you can't help but think that Stan Lee saying it, you think of Stan Lee and his contributions to comic books that were still felt today. Uh-huh. And for me, it's the most emotional I've got seeing Stan Lee since the Captain Marvel intro, which does all Stan Lee cameos instead of the usual characters. That one always hits me. But seeing him say that in this movie, it was good.
It's definitely more impactful than a lot of other stuff yet. I also do like that clip at the end of Deadpool 2, I think it is, when they're at this, some, it's like an interview clip where they ask Stan what they want his legacy to be. And it's just him basically saying, like, I really just hope they remember that I wrote some good stories with some great characters. And like, he just like, that's all he really wants his legacy.
I forgot all about that. Isn't it crazy? And that's in Deadpool.
That's at the end of Deadpool of all things. Yeah. It must have just been something in the Fox archives that like they must have shot during one of the X-Men movies that they just sort of detached at the end. But no, it's stuff like that where like you do see like I'm not going to lie. Stan Lee's probably a guy that had a pretty big ego at a certain point just because he was Stan Lee. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But it's those moments where you get like a little bit of humbleness where like he realizes that like what he has is very special and what he's created is very special and means so much to so many people. And that's the stuff that like really hits for me, because these characters are things that were hugely formative to me as a child. Like superhero comics are just things that like, you know, junior high school, I was the only kid reading superhero comics. Nobody else reading comics in high school and junior high when I was a kid. Nowadays, it's a little bit different. But back in my day.
Well, now there's even more kids that feel like you, right? You did. I mean, it's the cool thing. And whether it's comics or the movies, it really doesn't matter. There's a connection to these characters that started however many years ago.
There's a connection to these characters. And like, you know, people even say it about like, you know, Superman and stuff like that. I'm like, these characters have endured for a reason. They haven't endured for no reason. They mean a lot to a lot of people. And the one thing I can say watching all these movies back to back is they are coming from a place of somebody who clearly does love these characters. I don't think anything in these movies is done out of a misunderstanding. I think obviously you've got decisions that I don't agree with or things that I would have done differently, but I don't think anybody's coming from a place of malice. I think everybody's trying to do and honor Spider-Man as best they can. This movie, I think, I didn't have any problems watching it. And I think there's a lot of really good stuff here that just gets glanced over for what amounts to about 10 minutes of screen time plus a bit of a rushed finale.
I agree. I mean, it's some of the best, some parts that are some of the best Peter Parker or Spider-Man moments that we've seen on the screen yet. Ultimately, there's more that works than that doesn't work. Way more that works than what doesn't work.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And I think there's some really, really good stuff here that does get pretty glanced over.
I think that does it for us this week. Join us next time where we take a second look at another movie. And remember, maybe not every movie is great,
but all movies have greatness.
Thank you to Mark Benavides for singing our theme song. Follow him on Instagram at NotThatMarkAnthony. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with a friend. We certainly do appreciate that. And follow us on Twitter at BOTRcast. Thank you. Okay. I hit record. I'm going to scarf this down. I got like 2 inches left on my...
Sure. Oh,
I measure time in Slim Jim inches. Give me 2 inches of Slim Jim, man.
2 inches of Slim Jim. It's catching on. It's catching on. It's going to be a thing.